Hi folks, I'm Greg. How are we doing? All good. So I'm based out of Brisbane, originally Brisbane, but now Melbourne, Australia. Welcome along to this session. I never quite know to put some Azure topics and things into a data conference, but what I really want to do is spend a little while having a look at things that I think should be of interest to you in the Azure stack, and also in the power type applications as well. And what I find often is that people don't know what many of those services are or how they fit together or why they would even matter to them at all. So that's the aim of this session, is not a lot of depth, but we want to cover a large number of topics so that you know what those services are and which ones you might make use of. So look, where I fit in, I head up a company called SQL Down Under, a long-time data platform MVP, along with Erland and others in the room, and part of the Microsoft RD program that mostly just gets me on some interesting mailing lists within Microsoft, effectively, and been involved in the Certified Master program, and I do a bit of writing and involved in community as well. And so look, what I want to cover off, we've got a very quick discussion on the SQL database options, but then I want to get into the other data-related services to describe what's available there, then have a look at analytics, the apps, and then automation-related things that we can make use of, then spend a while in IoT, so Internet of Things and intelligence areas, and in particular, I'd say the intelligence areas are some of the ones that I'm most interested in what's occurring. And finally, I want to spend a little bit of time just talking about identity, because if you're going to start working with any of these services, identity is going to become one of the things you really have to get your head across sort of fairly quickly. And so the first thing is, look, we're not discussing, I don't really want to discuss so much infrastructure as a service. So I see an awful lot of my customers, they talk about having a cloud direction, but every time they talk about it, what they're talking about is just picking virtual machines up and putting them in the cloud, and they think this is some sort of cloud thing. To me, that's not really moving an organization in a cloud direction at all, right? That really is just sort of changing the hosting from where you happen to have it at the moment to somewhere else. And so there's obviously different layers of this. So we could have physical machines on premises. We might have virtualization on premises. We could then have virtualization in the cloud. But then the further we're heading up this, we could have platform services and then eventually, of course, software services at the top end. And so the thing you want to think about is, like, why would I want platform services and software services rather than just having virtual machines and things where I push up and run infrastructure? Look, most of the benefit that you'll get out of making some sort of cloud move will be when you start to move to platform services. These are the things that you stop managing on a very day-to-day basis. And this is really important. I find, even in our own case, we have our own, say, our website. We have an Azure website. The database, we've put in Azure SQL DB. And honestly, we really almost stop thinking about them from that point on. We do basic monitoring on a periodic basis, but it is nothing like when we used to manage virtual machines and worry about the operating system and things like that. The organizations that we work in, we make them have an interest in operating systems and service packs and things, but they don't want to know about that. They really don't. And the thing is, even in the smallest offerings in the platform services, they're already doing things way beyond what most people do in their own on-premises systems anyway. And so, for example, if you look at Azure SQL DB, the very bottom database that's offered already has, and this is $5 a month, already has three copies maintained online, at least in two separate fault domains, automated failover and so on. Like, do you do that yourself, you know, with your own systems? I mean, and this is a $5 a month database. This is ridiculous compared to what people do on-premises themselves. And so already, you're sort of well past that. Now, it's the same as if I look at things like Office 365. There are many organizations I go into where they're still running their own Exchange servers and things like that. I hear the reasons why they're doing that, but most of the time they're not particularly valid, right? And so to give you an example, a company I was at years ago, we ended up wanting to share calendars with Microsoft so we could sort of do free busy sharing of who's available and so on. I remember setting that up and the guys setting that up and configuring Link and so on. It was quite a nightmare getting that working. Now, has anybody done that at all? No. And look, by comparison, in Office 365, I went into the admin portal, checked a box that says Federate, and it's worked ever since, right? Now, I have no idea how that works, right? But the issue is, why would I want to know that, right? I mean, I have no interest in knowing that. And so what you need to be moving to is something where you're managing in a much more declarative manner. So instead of worrying about what is the operating system, what are the patching levels, all of these sort of things, you need to be starting to think about how big is it, how fast is it, where is it, where is there another copy of it? Words like this, not this sort of ongoing low-level management of all of this. This is not where you should be. Hourly billing is a big thing. If you have anything that involves seasonality, this becomes a really important thing. I think the best example I've ever seen of that, there was a company in the US who was selling tickets for concerts. And I don't know if anybody's ever been involved in that, but you can imagine if you go to sell tickets for a concert, I mean, typically within 10 minutes, you might sell maybe 15,000 tickets. The question is, what sort of equipment do you need to do that, right? And for most people, that's very, very expensive equipment to be able to do that. But you want it for 10 minutes. And that's simply silly, almost. And so what they ended up doing, I remember they had a discussion where they said, should we use 60 servers or 70 servers? And they ended up spinning up 200 servers. And in the end, the bill was hundreds of dollars, right? Where to buy that equipment would be millions of dollars, right? The equipment that could actually do that. And so anything that has any peak or trough, you need to stop and think about, is there another way we could do that? We had a spectacular failure in Australia of our first online census late last year. Made world news. It was embarrassing. But what they had done is they had worked out we had 18 million households in the country, and they had told the load testers that they needed to check whether a million households could do it at once over a period of an hour, of course. And so what ended up happening is it just crashed totally, and they were sort of blaming, they said, oh, it was a denial of service attack. But the denial of service attack was 12 million households all trying to do it at the time they told us to do it. It was just completely ridiculous. We just buried the system. I mean, they had specified it entirely wrong. But I can't help think that if they were in a reasonable environment where they could have scaled that very quickly if they needed to, they could have got around that, right? And could have dealt with that sort of thing. But it's the very fixed, older thinking that sort of led them into those sort of problems. The other thing is that when they have big events like that, you also know that it doesn't matter if it's Azure or the AWS people or whatever, they are going to make sure that those things work during those high-profile events as well, right? One of my friends, Tim Huckabee in the US, does all the systems that you see on CNN and things during the presidential elections with all the graphics and all the things that come up on the systems. And he said the degree of attack that those systems are under during those events is just hard to comprehend. And he said he could not have survived through those events without the support of what was going on in the data centers, with the teams of people who were looking and making sure that stuff works, you know, when you have high-profile events. Now, in terms of platform as a service, first is obviously faster development, because you're not trying to get these things provisioned. One of the things I hear all the time, I'm in sites where they tell me, but we can do this cheaper ourselves, right? And I was at one a little while ago where we needed to do some testing on availability groups. And they told me, no, you have to do this our way. And so they did it their way. It took them 6 weeks to get a quote on the machines. It then took another 4 weeks for those machines to arrive. And then after that, they then told us they couldn't plug them in because they couldn't take a power outage in the rack. And it was then another 4 weeks beyond that by the time we got the equipment installed. Now, if we had spun that up in Azure, we could have done the testing the next day and shut it all down again, right? Yet these people will tell me that somehow this is better doing it on premises. And those sort of things, it is just not sensible. That you need to be able to sort of think beyond doing it this way. So the infrastructure will be better. The other thing that's nice about the platform services is you're still working with the same tools as you were working before. And things like Management Studio and all the basic database tooling and stuff is still working exactly the same way and getting better at working with Azure. And I think, really, if you look at most applications in future, they won't be these monolithic things that we build today. I think they'll largely be glue that ties together services. I think that really is starting to become what's going to happen. And so we'll see more and more intelligent services, and our applications will just tie them all together. So look, SQL Database is obviously one. If you haven't been trying that, I'd suggest you do. I mean, people tried that earlier on. There were lots of limitations, lots of coding limitations, things like that. And unfortunately, the worst scenario is the migration one. And yet, when I look at the Microsoft materials, that's the one they focus on, because that's where most of the business is at the moment, and they're trying to work about bringing it across. If you're starting with something where you already have expectations that are quite different, then it's very hard sometimes to pick those things up and move them. It's not so trivial. But the other option you have is if you're building anything new, you know, I'd strongly encourage you to think about, could I build it on the basis that I could be doing this in a platform service instead? You've also got the ability for, as I said, built-in high availability and failover, usually much better than what most people have themselves. And you've got this ability to sort of scale up and down. And so we often do this, even for things like training classes. You know, I have a database that I use in some classes. I leave it as an S0 all the time. The morning of the class, I'll push it up to an S3. It runs great during the day, goes back to an S0 at the end of the day. Things like this. It's just you manage things differently to what you did before. But the thing is that the cost ends up being quite low, you know, when you do this sort of structure. Another thing that's happening is that they've got automated threat detection starting to occur in a lot of these services. Now, this is beyond what's there in the on-premises product right now. And so if you look at what they're doing, they're starting to do various types of SQL injection attack type issues and things like this. They're dealing with that at the service level and putting all sorts of detection and potential mitigation at the service level. In addition, they're starting to build auto-administration tools. Now, people look and go, well, you know, there's auto-tuning tools. They have started in the last little period. But again, I don't hold great hope for that in the short term, right? There are a lot of applications that where people have designed things incredibly badly and not done basic indexing and things, and it'll probably fix those, right? It probably will fix the majority of those. But most of the time, the problem I find with tuning applications is it's not the queries that are usually the problem, it's the application. And if I look at the performance tuning work we do, I would say 70% of the work we do is trying to get the application corrected in some way rather than the actual queries. And so to give you an example, I was at a site recently where 12,000 times a minute they were trying to load a list of countries. And you look at this and go, why are you doing this, right? I mean, the answer is not to work out how to make that query run faster. The answer is to work out how to stop it running the query, right? And so if I look at SQL Server, I think the usual thing is that if you're trying to get SQL Server to scale, I always tell the customers the best thing you can do is just stop talking to it, right? Because it's the barrage of queries that you're throwing at it that are going to be a problem. And in a cloud environment, that's going to be even more of a problem. So you need to avoid doing that. We've got Elastic options in there. You'll see these mentioned. And what they allow you to do is to build pools of databases that have sort of single charging and so on associated with it. Most of the time, people will be doing this for multi-tenant systems. And so it might be where we have a database per customer or something like that. Previously, that was cost prohibitive. It really was too expensive to do that before. But we're moving fast in an arrangement with the Elastic databases where that's getting to be a much better arrangement. The other thing they have are Elastic jobs and queries. So the idea we can issue a query and maybe do an update across a whole lot of different databases or change the structure of the database. They are becoming easier to do. What I see a lot of, though, is that people are worried about the fact they talk to one database and they say, I can't really reach out and talk to all the other ones very well. Well, now you can. The Elastic query things have this concept of external data sources and external tables and so on, which actually I think are a very good arrangement, and I hope end up in the on-premises database not too far away, because they'll be a better replacement for linked servers. But usually the idea, you need to be thinking about, do I really want to push all the queries through a single server anyway? I mean, a big part of the benefit in using a whole lot of different databases is the fact that you pick up the performance of all those separate databases. Now, SQL Data Warehouse is another product in the Azure stack. This one, I see a lot of people think this is just sort of a faster, bigger version of SQL Server. It's not. And most of the customers I have that have tried this have sort of backed back out of it again. And it's because they've gone into it thinking that what it'll be is a big, almost limitless storage database where they can throw enormous numbers of users at it. And that's really not what it's at. For me, where this product shines is when you have a small number of queries running over a very large amount of data, right? That's more what it's targeted at. Now, in terms of other data, sometimes we just need to store files. So Azure Storage is one of the things that you make good use of there. It's got a variety of things you can store. So blobs are the most basic thing, so just lumps of data. We also, there's a table storage there. So this does basic key value pair, like entity attribute value style tables. We can store those in there. They've got files now. So there's a concept of mounting it like a file system as well. And there's also queues that are in there. These are all REST-based interfaces, so basic sort of web technology for making the calls. And they've actually integrated this already into Management Studio and other tools. And so, for example, in SQL Server, we can do backups to Azure Storage. That's been built in now for several versions. So they've put provisions in Management Studio to let us connect to the storage so that we can start and look at what's going on there. The other tool I use a lot for that, I mentioned there, is Azure Storage Explorer. That one used to be up on CodePlex and was just a general purpose free tool that people could use. It really has come of age now. It's actually quite a good tool. Azure Search is one of my favorites as well. This one has been fairly expensive, but they've brought the price of it down quite a lot in recent times. But if you're trying to build things like predictive search, like someone type ahead, typing, have it guess what you're trying to type, those sorts of things, this is where Search will come in nicely for you. The other thing it does that's much richer than T-SQL type queries, it does do a lot of the full text style things as well. So it's got options that allow you to do stemming of words and indexing stemmed words and so on. So it does a much better job of understanding the language in those queries. The other thing it has is it has this sort of concept where you can have profiles. So I could say, look, if someone's searching in winter, I want to promote these particular things up the list of the searches that are returned. But when they hit summer, I then want to start promoting something else and so on. So you actually have this sort of concept of not just single lots of searches that return. DocumentDB has been around a while. This one is a JSON store, effectively, so basically for JSON objects or documents. And it, I think, had a bit of a slow start because people couldn't sort of people weren't exactly prepared for what it would do. But effectively what it's doing is storing things that are not table structured necessarily, but it can be sort of different shapes of JSON documents. It has a good way of querying it. It's a very SQL-like language. And in addition to that, it does sort of automatic tuning and automatic indexing on the queries and the of the documents itself. And so the documents end up indexed. So what you end up doing, instead of building indexes and things yourself, you're really controlling how much indexing do I want to achieve. So it's like how much indexing is occurring. And the other thing you're doing is you're controlling the degree of consistency. So you're saying, after what period of time? Is it immediately consistent, or is it some sort of thing that takes a period of time to become consistent? Now, quickly flip the name, because just last week, if you look at the previous one, they used to describe this as blazingly fast planet scale, which is a fairly big call, but now they've renamed it to Cosmos DB, so I presume much bigger again. But anyway, but you'll see this one all over the place. It's basically just Document DB has been rebranded and updated somewhat. Now, I'll quickly show you this. One of the things I like with Document DB is they've made it easier to start to get to learn it. And so, for example, they have a query playground. I wish we had one of these for T-SQL, I might add. And what they've done is they've loaded up a data set in here, a USDA food data set. And the idea is they then wander you through tutorials and things about learning to write the queries. And so in this playground, so the syntax, if you look at the syntax of this, it's a very SQL-like syntax that's been used here. And the idea is that you can get in here and try queries and run them, and every query returns JSON data coming back out the other end. And the idea is you can step through this, learn to do filtering, you know, see how order by is implemented and so on, top, and all the things that you're kind of used to within SQL. There's a SQL-style language here sitting over the top of this that gives you access to those JSON documents. It always intrigues me. I think I've worked with SQL as a language now since about the late 80s, and I think every single year I keep hearing about SQL's dead, and it's going to be replaced by, you know, pick new technology, pick anything you like. And yet every one of these new technologies, they end up building a SQL layer over the top of it because, you know, it just turns out to be the easiest way to get to the data. So it's great. All right. And so look, in terms of analytics, Chris Webb earlier in the day was talking about Azure Analysis Services. And so this has been added in recent times and basically allows us to pick up analysis services and have a platform service basis of that. The one thing to have a look at there, if you haven't played with it, the developer edition of that, there's a developer level which is fairly low cost by comparison with everything else. And it doesn't really say you can't use it for production things. You're not meant to. There's nothing that enforces that, but it has no service level agreements or things like that in place. And so, but you could certainly spend a lot of time in there learning to use it. And if you don't have analysis services on premises, this could actually be quite interesting to get to learn that. And it also, it's a tabular engine only. It doesn't have the multi-dimensional analysis services. In Chris's session earlier, he was saying, you know, he thinks there's enough people pushing for it that we should one day maybe get the multi-dimensional analysis services in the cloud. My take on that, I wouldn't be holding my breath waiting for that coming. So if I look at the product, they're very much moving down a tabular path. And they just seem to be filling in the things that are missing out of multi-dimensional each time the new version comes out. I just can't see them doing the work involved personally. But that could turn out to be wrong. Now, Power BI, of course, you will have seen lots of this over the last couple of years. And it's gone into an interesting mode now as well, where while we can use it to build data models and push them up to the cloud, the thing that has changed over the last couple of years is it was originally tied to Office 365, and that was actually a sort of a thing that stopped some people being able to use it and deploy it at the time. And so they've freed themselves from that, and they wanted to sort of radically change the situation so that the adoption could be quite widespread. And so the key thing they did is they released the desktop tool, so Power BI Desktop, and it wrapped up the functionality that was Power Query, which was the how do I go and find data and morph it into the right shape or transform it to get it in the right shape. We had Power Pivot, which allowed us to build the data model, which is the same as the analysis services tabular one. And then we had Power View. Now, Power View originally was in SharePoint. It's part of Excel, up to Excel 2016, but they've kind of taken it out of the menus and things for that because it was a Silverlight-based application, and it had to sort of disappear, really. And so they're downplaying it at the moment. But the same sort of functionality that was there is largely there in within Power BI Desktop. Now, any of the things you build in there, we can then push up to the Power BI Cloud service, and then we can build dashboards over the top of that. And so this gives us a really easy way to sort of build dashboards, get them up, and get them onto people's pieces of equipment. Because even most places I work in that do their own thing on premises, they always struggle with how do I get it to all the different people's phones and tablets and things and so on. And it just removes all of that problem, largely. Apart from the basic, how do we set up the gateways to do the connectivity. They've also got quite nice Windows, iOS, and Android apps. So there's a native apps that can be installed, say on Windows, there's a beautiful touchscreen app. So it isn't just the website you go to. Most people will probably never go to the website, most users of Power BI. They'll end up using it on their phones or on their tablets or maybe on some sort of desktop PC. I think that's where almost everybody will do it. One of the things that is quite different about this, though, it feels like a different Microsoft now, because they've opened this stuff up incredibly compared to where it was. Now, if we look at powerbi.com, I just want to quickly show you a couple of things in there. Looks like our connectivity is pretty good now, which is great. And so the basic idea here is that we... Yes, okay. Learn more? No, later. All right. And so the basic idea here is that we end up with a workspace, and the workspace... We have data sets that we can create and push up into here, so sets of data, like a data model with measures and things we can create over the top of that. We then build those into reports, so we build reports over the top of that, and then the idea is that the reports then get pinned to dashboards, and it's the dashboards are the thing that then get deployed and shared and so on. Most of these are quite rich, nice type of reports that are in here as well, and if I go back... In here, even including all the things with play access and so on, there's some quite nice animation in some of these things in terms of being able to stop and look at the data and sort of wander back over a period and those sort of controls. But the thing I think is really the nicest type of thing in here that will have the biggest impact down the track is all of the sort of Q&A style thing. The idea that I can go, look, you know, this year's sales and have it sort of tell me that that's this year's sales and say, look, you know, buy... maybe state or something, and have that sort of break that down for me, and it'll think because that's a sort of a mapping concept, maybe we need to stick that in a map, but I could say, look, as a stacked bar chart, you know, and so on, and have it pop to a bar chart, or be able to just say, look, I want that as a pie chart, you know, and so on. These things have become so easy to do, and I cannot describe to you enough that the number of times when I show these things to like CEOs, there are most people are pretty jaded nowadays, but these are the sort of stuff that people look at and go, I must have that, you know? there's no maybe about that, now, because they all know how hard it is to get data out of their systems right now. And so they scream out for this sort of stuff, you know, when they're exposed to it. Now, the other thing with Power BI that makes it, as I said, kind of a different Microsoft now, if I look at one of these reports and we go into sort of editing, you've got a lot of visualizations that we can use and different ways of showing the data. But what they did, it's quite unlike Microsoft, is then picked all the code for the visualizations up and put it in GitHub and said, look, if you don't like how those chart works, you can change it, right? And so you can go and build your own versions of all of these things. That's a very, very different company to the one before. And what they then did is build the ability for us to do our own custom ones. And so if you look, there's a Power BI custom visuals. There was a separate gallery for that. They're in the middle of moving it to the Microsoft Store at the moment, which I think is actually a mistake, but we'll see. But what it does is, this is where Microsoft staff and the community have gone in and start to build visualizations that are so much better than the things that are already in the product as well, and really enhance the experience. Like I had a company just recently, absolutely loves a little water gauge. You know, they're like a water type company and so on, and they just love having the ability to have things like that as visuals in the middle of their dashboards and stuff. It really is a strong story. I'm presuming Marco Russo and Alberto Ferrari would probably come to this sort of conference some years. The guys there, they've done a synoptic panel, which is a really interesting thing. So the synoptic design panel. And this one takes it even further, where they've then built a designer for the layouts, where you then build visualization over the top of the design. So, for example, here, if you look, they've got a generic aircraft, and you can start doing things, laying out seats and so on. Or they have... Let me scale it back down a bit. I had a hospital, literally, the other day, a hospital sort of really excited about being able to highlight parts of a body and things like that. You know? This is very, very interesting where this goes, and sort of way beyond anything that we've been doing in standard charts and things in the past. Right? This stuff has a really, really strong future. All right. Now, a couple of other ones in this family. There's a thing called Power Apps. And this one, I almost see, it feels a bit like VB1 for the Power BI crowd. It's basically a sort of a very elementary design surface where you can build simple applications. I mean, effectively, that's what it is. And so if you had to build little data input forms and those sorts of things, it actually works very, very well for that sort of thing. Now, what it does under the covers, though, is it either hits a very simplistic data model at the moment. They have a new thing coming called the Common Data Model that's going to sit under this and a number of other products. But anything beyond that, what you need to do is then go off and call functions instead of sort of executing sort of ad hoc code and things directly so much. And so this keeps it to a very, very simple structure. This the Power App itself is an app that also installs on your phone and tablets and so on, and then allows you to run these applications that you build using this. Another one in this category, there's Logic Apps, and mostly where I see people using these are people who are sort of migrating from things that often are BizTalk on-premises, and they're looking at trying to work out how to get the equivalent sort of logic occurring. Most of the things that this does are business-to-business and EDI-style connections and so on. And there's the one I like most at the moment, though, is Flow. And this one you may or may not have played with. If you've looked at other products like Zapier and some of those, it's along the similar lines. But what I'm seeing increasingly is customers who want to use best-of-breed different applications, and then the question is, how do I tie them together, right? So if I have a membership system for my superannuation company, and I want to have members from here into a financial planning application, but every time I put them in there, I also want to add them into Salesforce. And then if, you know, something occurs in Salesforce, I want to push them into a drip or a MailChimp mailing automation campaign and so on. The question is, how do you tie all that stuff together, right? And that's what Flow is. And so where Flow fits is the ability to build sort of event-driven processes in each of these different best-of-breed applications and then have data flow between them as things occur. And if you haven't played around with this sort of thing, I really encourage you to do so, because so many customers I'm dealing with at present, this is a really core thing that they're trying to work out how to do. And we'll talk about identity later, because that's a big issue in amongst this. But there's an incredible power here in being able to say, look, when I add something here, push an entry up here, start a mailing campaign, you know, when they respond to that, push it back into sales, you know, and so on. It's really important to be able to tie all of these things together. Azure Functions are another one. This is a lighter weight thing than Logic Apps, and these are becoming very, very popular very quickly. And so what Azure Functions is the ability in a whole lot of different languages, doesn't have to be just C# or something, but it allows you to build functions in those languages, and then it provides all the infrastructure for housing that. So it's a serverless thing, a bit like people might use Node or something like that on premises and so on. The idea is that this provides a complete infrastructure there where I can set functions up and I can just make a request, call the function, have it go off and do whatever it needs to do and return back. In addition, it has timer-based functions, so you can use it to cause things to occur at a particular point in time. And this is a good example where if you're using Azure SQL DB, we currently don't have an agent in the cloud, but pretty much everything that you would want to try and do with that, you could do via timer-based processing coming out of Azure Functions, right? But even in things like Power Apps, if I'm building an application, the best place to build the more complicated logic is to call from the app to an Azure function and then have it do the work, right? Rather than doing that inside the app itself. Now, another area here, let me just check timing. So now it's tight, this one. Another area is Internet of Things and intelligence. And these are more areas that I think you might not have touched much on in the past. And so the first thing is that these, if you're dealing with data, these are areas that are starting to have enormous volumes of data. You can imagine that real quantities of data come out of machines, not out of people, right? So it's one of the things I was doing a while back was tracking years ago things like even pages that people were using to page people. And if you looked at all the pager traffic, I would say 90% of it even then was machine-generated sort of pager traffic. So all sorts of events and things occurring are just a stream of data that's being picked up, and we're generating enormous volumes of data. Now, in terms of the Internet of Things stuff, the first thing is where do you put that, and how do you start dealing with and collecting this information? And so the option that's provided in here in Azure is a thing called Event Hubs. Now, the idea of an Event Hub is a place that can just collect events for you as they occur. And so the most simple version of that is I can make a web request when something occurs. It can be HTTP or HTTPS. And I can send a payload up, and it'll remember that event. That's what it does. Now, to give you an example of that, we've got a company in Australia that what they're doing is they're getting little Raspberry Pi computer boards, tiny little boards, and they're going around and putting them in all the white goods stores who sell microwaves and fridges and all of these things. And literally every time you open a door or lift a lid on a washing machine, it's sending an event into this event hub, right? And that way, they can stream the data out of the event hub. They can watch real time at who's looking at what models and things and stuff. It's really interesting, the information coming back out of that. It's almost a bit intrusive. Some people start to find it a little bit over the top almost. Where it's going even further, though, there's a company who runs supermarkets all around Australia, and they've become a bit notable in Perth because they started now doing, as soon as you walk into the supermarket, they start tracking your MAC address as you walk around the supermarket, and they track every place you stop, how long you stop, you know, all in theory anonymous, but yeah, not not so much. I mean, because they know when you got to a particular cash register, you know, or whatever. But it's almost kind of spooky, the degree of stuff that they're doing. And when you start then coupling that with things seriously, with overhead cameras looking at facial positions and stuff, this is also almost starting to get quite spooky, really. But when they're talking to advertisers, they know now that when somebody walked down that aisle, did they look at that advertisement or not? You know, did they then go over, you know, this sort of stuff is almost a bit scary. But you can imagine the volume of data coming out of this stuff, right? And so this is the sort of place that these are going into, is an event hub. Now, if you've got a very big stream of data going quite fast, there's also a protocol called AMQP, which is really just like a connected protocol. So the idea is you form a connection, then you just send events up the whole time. And that's faster than making separate HTTP requests every time. But if you've got low volume things, HTTP requests is what goes. Now, this is all time-based buffering. It can do millions a second without any problem at all. The scale on this allows you to scale it up or down. Again, you have different control over how fast the event hubs work, and they have a whole lot of client libraries to make this easy to work with. Now, the question is then, what do you do with all that data when it gets up there? And so Stream Analytics is the next product in this list. And so Stream Analytics is another one that you probably should get familiar with if you haven't already. Now, where this comes from, back in SQL Server 2008 R2, they introduced Stream Insight. It was one of the products that was, they called it a product, but it wasn't really a product. Did anybody actually use Stream Insight? And that's what I would have thought. Yeah, okay. So what happened is they created something. They were sort of pushing it in with the SQL Server product. But what they really had built was just a series of .NET libraries that was, they weren't a product. They were something somebody could build a product on, right? And the problem is they were out talking to the normal data community going, hey, look at this thing. And everybody's going, why would I want that? You know, I mean, it wasn't a product. What they've now done is turn it into a product. And so what happens is you've got the ability now to build standing queries that sit inside Azure and run. Now, the thinking here is if you think about normal database queries, the way they work is we normally get the data, we shove it in a database, and then we run queries over the top of the data that's been stored. But the problem is if the data starts coming faster and faster, you get to a point where you can't receive it and store it fast enough to then start running the queries, right? So you can imagine it works fine for most data that we work with in our businesses, but if you start trying to say, look, how would I run a query over, you know, Ethernet packets, or how would I run a query over, you know, data that really is coming in at high speed, the question is, how could you do that, right? And the answer is you have to have the query already running all the time. You throw the data through the query, but it's only the outcomes of that that go in the database. We don't put the data in the database and run the query because it's just far too fast and far too much data. Now, this one is not at the network packet query type level, where Stream Insight could do that sort of stuff, right? And so it was actually a much, much higher speed thing. But in the case of Stream Analytics, what this is allowing us to do is to take that stream of events that we've pushed up in event hubs, and then we can run SQL-like queries over the top of the stream of data. We can combine that with data from databases. So maybe, for example, if we have a toll booth on a highway, we could be picking up all of the tokens as people pass the booth. We can be reading all the data out of that, and we can be combining that with a thing that looks up, you know, your registration number or whatever for your token. And then we start doing processing over the top of that. But what's interesting with this is we can do things that are window-based. So I could say, I can do aggregates that say, tell me maybe how many vehicles passed in this lane in the last minute, right? Or things like this. So we have window-based aggregates over the stream of data. And this is really important. And it's not only just the data that's there, it's things when the data's missing. So maybe it's if no vehicles have come out of that lane in the last 30 seconds, maybe there's a problem in that lane, you know, if the people are entering at the other end. And so we can start to do those sort of detection things as well. Similarly, electricity authorities are able to look at consumption of power in different parts of the city in real time and, of course, start to easily work out things like there is a problem there if everybody stops consuming power. There's probably a problem over there, right? These sort of things are the sort of things you can do with Stream Analytics. There was another good example with a company in the US who were doing breathing machines that they were using in clinics, and they were worried about how well the machines were being used. And so what they've done now is they've enabled all of the machines that send to constant events back to event hubs. They're running Stream Analytics over the top of that, and that allows them to then, in Power BI, actually, then have dashboards that show them how effectively the machines are being used and things like, are there air quality problems in different parts of the country and these sorts of things all coming out of that. And so one of the beauties of Stream Analytics is that when we're in Power BI, I don't know if I still have that open or not. But in when we're in Power BI, right down the bottom here in the data sets, when we start doing get data, we have options in here to get streaming data sets as well. And so you're able to sort of build some types of charts and reports that work straight over the top of streaming data coming out of Stream Analytics. And so that's what this is. Now, it's got, as I said, you know, again, what a surprise. It's a SQL-like language that they use to query all the events. As I said, I'm not too worried about SQL going away too quickly. But it's all time-based, so everything is done on a sort of a time. So if I look at, so select timestamp here, I'm doing a count from this input, picking what I'm using for the time, and then you say group by this, a tumbling window of an hour long. And this is a type of a window where the window just sort of takes a set of data, then tumbles over and gets the next set, and then gets the next set. But there are also sliding windows and hopping windows and, and stuff anyway that are different ways that you can do aggregates over the streams of data. But again, it's a little bit out of the side of things you might normally look at, but enormous amounts of data come out of these things and have real potential in businesses. The other area, of course, is machine learning. And this is one that has got a lot of attention in recent times. One of the things that, if you look back in the early 90s, there was a period around 1992 where they finally, in the company inside Microsoft, sort of convinced Bill Gates that the internet was going to matter. And all of a sudden, he did this sort of pivot where every product in the company suddenly became internet-enabled, right? Now, the thing to understand is that a few months ago, they did that with AI and machine learning. And what I'm seeing is more and more and more products coming out all the time. Every single product, they're looking at how do we tie machine learning and AI into the product, right? This is becoming really important. I was having a chuckle earlier in the day when the presenter early in the day said he spoke five languages, and it was English and Australian and American and so on. That was kind of cool. But to give you an example of that sort of thing, they announced... Where is it? This one here. Another one I noticed just today, a new garage project, but this actually is a presentation translator that takes PowerPoint presentations and in real time allows attendees to sit and watch in up to 60 languages with constant translation while the event's going on and so on. This stuff is getting very powerful, very fast, right? When we had Ignite in Australia a couple of months ago, they were using the new language understanding services and the one that does the speaker recognition. And literally, they had several speakers on the stage, and in real time, there were near-perfect translation transcriptions coming up of everything the people were saying. It really was something to behold. And so the thing with machine learning is that it's been an important thing for some period of time. But there was a period in the early 90s where there was this great promise of AI, and it was a largely unfilled thing. Like, the ideas were all sound, but things didn't end up... We couldn't actually do it at the time. What's changed now in the last few years is things are actually starting to work. And this is a big deal. It's hard to describe how important this stuff is. Now, Microsoft has, you'll notice, already started to embed R in SQL Server. In 2017, they've embedded Python in there now as well as the languages that are commonly used in this. There's a really big push. I'm on several internal projects going on in Microsoft where they're just looking at how you use machine learning to enable things. As a simple example, in Power BI Desktop, we've had the ability to add custom columns and so on. But you may or may not have noticed, but about a month ago, they added add column by example. So, you know, not go in there and write the formula and work out how to put the new column in there. Start showing it what the data looks like out of all the other columns and have it try and work out the formulas, right? And so on. This is where this stuff is going really fast, okay? And so you'll find every product, they're looking at how does this get embedded into the products. There is a professional program for data science. I went through this and did this last year. It was really quite interesting, actually. It was a part Microsoft. They had there was a guy from Denmark teaching some of the R subjects and so on. They had quite a mixture of people from different places around the world. I actually found it really quite interesting. And that runs about every 3 months at the moment. I encourage you to have a look at that. There's also a big data one as well. Now, in terms of machine learning, Azure Machine Learning, just so you're aware of what that's there for, and let me close this out, actually. And so there's a thing called ML Studio where you can go in and start to build machine learning models and so on. All right. So this is a visual thing that we build models on inside a browser. And so notice here I've got a number of what they would consider experiments. And so this is an experiment I was sort of building previously. And what they do at the end of the professional program, they get you to enroll in a competition, which is one of the Cortana intelligence competitions, and they get you to go through and start to build a model to sort out a particular problem. This one here, it's very familiar. If you've done work with integration services, it feels a lot like that. Right? So the idea is I've got like a source of data sitting up here. I've applied a number of SQL transforms. It's actually SQLite, not T-SQL. And the idea is I can then even things like visualize what that data looks like inside here. I can drill in, find out what the values look like and so on. But then the idea is I can split the data, maybe, drag out a train of a model. I want to score the model. I picked a two-class boosted decision tree. But again, there are a whole bunch of different models and things in here, and so scoring and how we initialize the model. If I'm doing classification, there are just a ton of absolutely world-class implementations of these algorithms and things. It is amazing what's in here now. And you can sign up and work with this stuff completely for free, right? Now, that gets you a lower-powered one when you're doing it, but it is wickedly cool as to how this stuff works. And the nice thing with this is not then just building the model, you're able to turn it into a product or something you can use. So the idea down here is once you have the model built, you then and run, you can then say, look, set up as a web service. It goes off and builds the web service for you. It builds all the scaffolding. It then goes and does things like builds all the documentation that shows you how to make all the calls. It builds example code in C and Python and R that shows you how to call the web service and so on. It's amazing, you know, what it does. And it just builds that whole thing for you and then can house those web services so you can just call these models dynamically in the middle of your own applications. You can now build and set up and stage, you know, a machine learning model in minutes and have it up and live online. I cannot describe how long that used to take to do. And so this is really, really interesting where this product's going. And so the other one in this is the Cortana Intelligence Suite. And what's occurring here is that they're building more and more intelligent services that are part of this suite of things. And so what's going to happen when I look forward and I say, what's going to be different about, say, Azure and AWS and so on? The thing that's occurring that's different is you're going to have different services that are platform services available from these different types of data centers. And this is the thing that's going to differentiate a lot of these places. Now, one of the things that has really pushed this along well and truly is introduction of what the field program will Gatorade. Now, sounds like a mouthful, but what that really is about is if you look back in the 1940s and 50s, we sort of built special purpose-built computers mostly at the time. Then in the 50s, we got to sort of stored program computers where we'd build a general purpose machine and then drop programs into it that make it do whatever we want to do. But that was never the fast thing to do, right? I mean, the idea was we're building a general purpose machine. What's now occurring is that they're building machines and they're hard burning into the machines. Here is a machine that does speech recognition. Here is a machine that does language understanding. Here is a machine that does image recognition and so on. And these things are getting placed in the data centers. And so this is why, you know, these things can be 100 or 1,000 times faster than something you could run in a standard stored program machine. And so this is really changing the game in terms of how fast these things work and how effectively they work. And so already in Cortana for language understanding, this is a great example where they can now just transcribe text, transcribe speech. If you look back a few years, anybody has ever used any of the things like Dragon Dictate or any of those sort of programs? You go back a few years, and they typically, you had to spend ages training them, and they had something like about a 40% error rate, right? Now, that's been dropping and dropping and dropping. Microsoft's team in Shanghai, they have a whole bunch of people doing that machine learning. They posted earlier last year, they posted a 5.9% error rate untrained. Right? And why that was really, really significant is that 5.7% was human level. Right? Later last year, they posted 5.3%. So they are now exceeding human ability to listen to speech and transcribe it, and in up to enormous number of languages coming forward as well. It is hard to describe the impact of that. Just simply that, being able to take speech and turn it reliably into text. And as I said, better than people. The text analytics, which are doing the sentiment analysis and those things, language, spell checking, the translator. I don't know, I'll wait. I've been learning Chinese the last few years, punishing myself trying to do that. And every day I see how good Google Translate is and Bing Translate, and I'll wait and see what the translation's like. I think that might take a while longer. But things like speaker recognition, this can listen to a set of text and pull out the parts where different people are talking, right? This sort of stuff. Translator speech API, recommendations. This is all of the prediction type engines. The academic knowledge one says, go and find me references out live for this sort of material. The face API is really important. This one now is the, everybody thought it was funny when it first appeared, where you could upload your face and say, I think you are 42 and I think you're, you know, whatever. But the thing is, they were using that to train the machines, right? And they're just getting better and better and better all the time. And the face API now is amazing. You can just upload an image and it'll tell you there's a 52-year-old guy there looking happy, there's a 36-year-old woman over in this part of the thing looking sad and so on. It's amazing what comes back in a simple call. Vision APIs for this, content moderation and so on, they are just adding service after service after service. And the thing is that these are all being built on top of the previous ones that are there, and it really is becoming interesting. I do just want to quickly mention identity, because if you're going to use a whole lot of these services, one of the challenges is who are you in amongst all of these different things? And so you'll find, spend some time with Azure Active Directory, because you'll find that it's a really, really important one to be able to help work with that. Now, the last thing I just want to show you, I don't know if you've seen, but one of the ones that Microsoft posted a little while ago, I'll see if I can get this sound a bit closer to it.
A man drinks orange juice, adjusts his watch, then opens a door. He emerges from a train station with sunglasses and a white cane, then walks along a London sidewalk.
I'm Sakib Sheikh. I lost my sight when I was 7. And shortly after that, I went to a school for the blind. And that's where I was introduced to talking computers. And that really opened up a whole new world of opportunities. I joined Microsoft 10 years ago as a software engineer. I love making things which improve people's lives. And one of the things I've always dreamt of since I was at university was this idea of something that could tell you at any moment what's going on around you.
He taps sunglasses to take a picture.
I think it's a man jumping in the air doing a trick on a skateboard.
He types out a computer, then sits with colleagues.
I teamed up with like-minded engineers to make an app which lets you know who and what is around you. It's based on top of the Microsoft Intelligence APIs, which makes it so much easier to make this kind of thing. The app runs on smartphones, but also on the Pivot Head smart glasses. When you're talking to a bigger group, sometimes you can talk and talk and there's no response and you think, is everyone listening really well? Or are they half asleep? And you never know.
He taps his sunglasses.
I see two faces, 40-year-old man with a beard looking surprised. 20-year-old woman looking happy.
The app can describe the general age and gender of the people around me and what their emotions are, which is incredible.
In a restaurant,
One of the things that's most useful about the app is the ability to read out text.
Hello, good afternoon. Here's your menu.
Great, thank you. I can use the app on my phone to take a picture of the menu, and it's going to guide me on how to take that correct photo.
Move camera to the bottom right and away from the document.
And then it'll recognize the text. Read me the headings.
I see appetizers, salads, paninis, pizzas, pastas.
Years ago, this was science fiction. I never thought it would be something that you could actually do. But artificial intelligence is improving at an ever faster rate. And I'm really excited to see where we can take this.
In a park with a woman.
As engineers, we're always standing on the shoulders of giants, building on top of what went before. And in this case, we've taken years of research from Microsoft Research to pull this off.
I think it's a young girl throwing an orange frisbee in the park.
For me, it's about taking that far-off dream and building it one step at a time. I think this is just the beginning.
The Microsoft logo.
It's kind of cool, hey? Anyway, listen, thanks, folks. All good, and we're done. Thank you. Hang around for a while.